Leiden. This is The Connection. Important people from around the world are paying their respects to the late Syrian President Hafez al-Assad today in Damascus. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is attending the funeral from the United States. The Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, who's been a bitter rival of Assad's, is also there. Arafat saluted the coffin and then kissed Assad's son and designated heir Bashar Assad. Bashar Assad may be something of a reluctant heir. He was a practicing eye doctor living in London until his brother Basil, who was his father's first choice of successor, got killed in a car crash in 1994. Until last weekend, Bashar's official title was head of the Syrian Computer Society. Now he's part of a new generation of Arab leaders who've been bequeathed power by their fathers, a generation born after the Arab-Israeli wars, men with no military and minimal political experience. If he can consolidate his power and be named president by parliament in the next few weeks and then be approved in a popular referendum, Bashar Assad then faces several challenges: to bring Syrian society into the modern age and to outline a role for Syria in the peace negotiations with Israel and a regional presence in the Middle East. We're talking about Syria after Assad this hour. Joining us from Damascus is the Christian Science Monitor's reporter Scott Peterson. In London, Ahmed Khalidi joins us. He's a senior associate member of St. Anthony's College at Oxford and a writer on the Middle East. In San Antonio, Texas, is David Lesh, a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255, and the question roughly is, whither Syria at the death of Hafez al-Assad? 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Scott Peterson, what does one see with one's naked eyes in Damascus today?
Well, there were definitely remarkable scenes this morning at the funeral, especially as the cortege came through Umayyad Square, which is one of the main intersections in Damascus. People had been told to be there between 8 and 10 o'clock in the morning, and that was the time that the cortege was going to come by. And people really began to arrive at 5 o'clock. It was remarkable to see the columns of people as they began to approach. It was a very quick turnaround. The cortege came down. People surged as much as they could past the police and the soldiers. They kept a tough line, but what was remarkable was to see how people's reactions in the crowds were. I mean, especially among the youth, who you wouldn't think would have quite the same affinity for Hafez al-Assad as for the son. There really were scenes of very dramatic emotion and people collapsing. The emergency workers were going all out to try and revive people.
What has the assumption been about succession? Hafez al-Assad has been an enormously powerful figure, but a conspicuously ill man for, 15 years. This day was going to come. What do people assume?
Well, I think they assume that at least here, that Bashar is going to be able to make all the right moves, that already there is a small, very small group that is loyal to his father that is scripting this entire transition at the moment. So far, it's gone almost flawlessly, except for the fact that last night we had a statement from Assad's brother,
yes,
who actually has been in exile for the last 15 years or so. But except for that, really, so far, all the organs of state power are slowly being collected, or even quickly in some cases, especially with the military, being collected by Bashar.
And what are the ripples from Rifat, the brother in exile, who's calling the succession illegitimate?
Well, what he's saying is that basically he is actually the legitimate ruler of Syria, but he hasn't been here for 15 years. And you'll remember that he actually staged a coup in 1983, rolling tanks of his defense brigades out onto the streets of Damascus, taking advantage of a time when Hafez al-Assad had a heart attack. Basically, the regular army stood up, and as they did so, Rifat's troops pulled back. But it's quite remarkable. Some members of the Alawite community do support Rifat and think that he's the only member of the family that can actually save, you know, keep the Alawite minority in power. But it seems, though, that Bashar has really come on in these last couple of years, and especially the last couple of months, in ways that I think that most members of that community haven't didn't know about before.
Ahmed Khalidi in London, welcome to The Connection. You know, you said to me years ago that, in the language of the movie The Graduate, The one word to remember in the Middle East is Syria.
I must say, I've completely forgotten about that, naturally.
Well, you remember that moment in the movie when he said one word, young man,
yes.
Plastics.
Indeed.
What did it mean then, and what in the world does it mean now to focus on Syria in the Middle East?
Well, I think the basic problem or issue is this. Syria is a very major player, particularly in the Levant, so that's the eastern part of the Arab world. And any attempt to create a peace settlement in the area that excludes Syria, any attempt to build a regional, any kind of regional stability that does not include Syria, any attempt to form regional axes or alliances which Syria opposes, is naturally going to create major, major problems. So I think the main thing to remember is that Syria is not just Bashar, it's not just Hafez al-Assad. It is a regional power of major proportions. It is the one Arab state that still has potentially the prospect of going to war with Israel in any real sense. And it is a state that is quite heavily armed and quite capable in military terms, and certainly a power not to be ignored by any of the other regional parties.
Well, this was Hafez al-Assad's role in life, to be, if not a rejectionist, sort of the reluctant, necessary man who wasn't there at the table. And yet, you could also suppose that time was running out on that kind of strategy.
Well, you know, Assad tended to take a very long view of things. His view was steeped in his own cultural and ideological coloring. He had a very particular view of the nature of the conflict with Israel. He didn't feel, I think, at any one stage in any great hurry to achieve this deal. He did make a decision quite some time ago, I would say some time in the early 70s, even before the 1973 war. He came to the decision, as did most of the Arab countries, that a negotiated settlement with Israel was the only likely outcome of this conflict. But I don't think he felt that he was in any desperate rush to achieve this if the terms and the circumstances weren't right.
Well, does the strategy of saying the world must come to me still apply in Syria to Bashar, for example?
I think Bashar is going to have a very hard time avoiding or shrugging off the legacy of his father on this issue in particular. He may be able to be slightly more liberal, to have more margins of maneuver in the internal scene in terms of the economy, in terms of opening up generally to the West. But I think on the issue of a peace settlement with Israel, the legacy of his father is going to bear very heavily on his shoulders. I don't see for the time being any chance that he's going to be more flexible than his father.
David Lesh, you know Bashar Assad somewhat. You've met him. Can you tell us more
about a couple times, yeah.
More about the man himself?
Well, he's he has an overt gregariousness and compassion, I think, is very appealing to those of us that have become accustomed to the dour nature of many of Syria's leading officials. And I think this is kind of symptomatic of Bashar's first career choice, that is ophthalmology, the study of which in London, as you said, he was plucked from in 1994 when his elder brother died in a car accident. All of this, however, does not necessarily make for a successful Syrian president. Indeed, whispers in Damascus over the past few years, when it was clear that Bashar was being groomed for the presidency, indicated a clear concern that he was just too plain nice to become the next line of Damascus. But there's, I think, risk and opportunity here with Bashar. The risk, of course, is that he is untested, inexperienced, that the grooming process was interrupted midstream and may not have been entirely completed. That is, his father had not cleared all of the obstacles out of the path for his son to rule as well as reign. The opportunity is that, as Ahmed Khalidi mentioned, is that he does have a chance to be a different type of president over time, certainly not in the short term because his father's legacy is so heavy. But in the long term, he has a chance to be a different type of president because he is from a different generation. I think Basil, who died in 1994, as I mentioned, would have been very much the same type of president as his father. Bashar, having grown up in a different political, sociological, cultural milieu, and having been to the West, liking Phil Collins, as you said, and being something of a computer nerd and wanting to open up Syria to the West, again, if he's able to consolidate power, which is, I think, a considerable if, that he has the opportunity to take Syria in a different direction, which I think bodes well for Syria economically, politically, and culturally.
Talk, all of you, about consolidating power here. I mean, one just knows without knowing that there's a tightly organized military and intelligence apparatus of state here that Hafez al-Assad built and ruled with an iron fist. Who runs this nowadays? Ahmed, do you know?
Well, I think it's important to note that over the past year, with Assad Senior's direction, Bashar has been at the head of a anti-corruption campaign, which ostensibly has to do with clearing out centers of power who have abused their economic position, but also parallel with that, of course, the object of which was to clear the way for the younger Bashar succession. And as a result of this, some of the major figures that were very well entrenched in the military and the security establishment in Syria were swept away. Hikmet Shahab, the old chief of staff, Ali Duba, Brahim Najjar, all very senior figures in the old-style Assad-led coalition of Alawite and military officers who ruled Syria, all of whom were swept out of power in the past 6 months to 1 year, and I think giving Bashar a much better chance, perhaps, of consolidating his grip than he otherwise might have had.
Mm-hmm. Christopher, can I comment on that?
David Lech, please.
Yes. It's important to remember that Bashar's name was attached to that anti-corruption campaign, as Ahmed Khalidi mentioned. How much he could actually carry that out on his own, obviously, he couldn't have done it without his father. How much he can do it now. And again, it's been something the last year or so, last 2 years, as Hafez al-Assad's health has noticeably deteriorated. It's been something of a race against time to clear the path for his son. And that's the big question. As Ahmed mentioned, many people have been moved out of potential opposition, has been moved aside, put into exile.
Scott Peterson?
There have also been some other signals as well, which are actually more on the military front, which people here in Damascus at least say show that Bashar may have overcome that sense of being a bit too nice, and that occurred last fall when we had these Bashar's people went in. And, well, people that were connected to Bashar and apparently under his direction in some respects, and arrested as many as 1,000 people or maybe more in Latakia. Now, these in northern Syria, these were people who were basically loyalists of Rifat, who we mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that they were apparently dealt with quite diplomatically. Their names were taken down and everything else, and they were let go. And the sense that I get from Syrian analysts here is that because they were dealt with so nicely, Rifat thought that he would push the point and basically ask for people to gather and make a stand. The response from Bashar and from the military was to go in literally tanks, air, and by sea and destroy the port area where this group had been, and the message that was apparently meant to be sent was that this was going to be, you know, that he could play hardball as well. So
no
there
more,
are,
Mr.
There
nice.
Have been some signals that way.
Scott Peterson, I wish you'd just give us, if you can, a kind of picture postcard of Damascus today, specifically in the context of Tom Friedman's remark in the New York Times yesterday. He said if Syria were in Asia, it would be called North Korea. Does Syria, as an American walks through it today, feel like the other side of the moon or not?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would actually make more of a comparison, for example, to Cuba in terms of the economic problems. And in fact, there's a very noticeable comparison. One is that both in Cuba and here, you've got 1950s vintage cars still driving the streets, and it's American cars, and it's one of the very rare places where you find that. But you don't have the kind of social control or things that that I think that you would find in North Korea. I haven't been in North Korea myself, but certainly in terms of stagnation, this country has really been in a time warp for most of the last generation and has only very recently begun to recognize the need to pull out, or at least recognize the gap that is existing. And in terms of, and there are also some very other more concrete examples of that, and one is the state of the military. This was a military that was propped up for many, many years by the Soviet Union. At the end of the Cold War, the great patron of Syria disappeared, as did all the money, and there really has been very little in the way of military replenishment ever since then. So the military that existed 10 years ago and that was such a great threat to Israel is no longer such a great threat. I mean, they just have not been able to keep up a technological edge, and when push has come to shove, they've even had difficulty deploying tanks to their northern border in an emergency that occurred a year and a half ago. So
is it fair to say
there are all sorts of things factoring in?
Is it fair to say, as we have, that Syria has taken a pass on modern technology in general? I mean, that the cell phones and electronic consumerware that you see all over the rest of the Middle East and the Third World is not on site?
Yeah, I think that they have, or that the intention, I mean, had been to take a pass on it. But I think there's also recognition that it's really virtually impossible today to do that. And one case in point is the fact that satellite dishes here and satellite television are still illegal, and yet this country, among all the others that I've seen in the Middle East, has more satellite dishes per person than you would find anywhere. And my understanding was that one of the ways that they were able to get so many of those into Syria, often smuggled through from Lebanon, was that they said at the customs border they would be a nod nod wink wink, don't worry, these are for the security forces. That was how that they were brought in from Lebanon, some in such large numbers to begin with. But that is something remarkable, that Syrians are seeing the whole rest of the world all the time. And of course that's raised expectations, because in that aspect there really haven't been limitations. People have seen everything else.
If I might jump in here,
Chris, yes, Ahmed.
Commenting on a couple of things that Scott Peterson was saying. I think you know, Tom Friedman's comment is more reflection on the fact that obviously Tom hasn't been there, I think, for quite some time. He's been to Damascus recently. I doubt whether he would have seen it in the same light.
I agree.
Obviously, there are things that still smack of the old Soviet-style Romania, and Syria hasn't moved very far in terms of its basic political institutions. But I think in terms of the openness to the outside world, the fact that people in Syria now, as Scott was saying, satellite dishes are so prevalent that the outside world is no longer really on the outside anymore. You can see it in the way that people behave, the things, the clothes that they wear, the kind of things that the young seek, the music they listen to. I mean, there has been over the past, I'd say, 5 to 8 years, an incredible change in terms of Syria's relationship to the outside world, not necessarily in terms of its basic political structures, but in terms of societal attitudes. And this is something that Bashar, I think, will both want to build on and want to be very careful so that it doesn't run totally out of control, because it is the kind of thing that can act either way. It's both an opportunity and a challenge.
In popular culture and in popular politics, I'd ask you both, or all of you, what is Syria's perspective on the United States these days? David Lesh?
Well, Syria has, in fact, one of the things that Hafez al-Assad has been accused of, especially by those in Israel on the right wing who question his motives with regard to peace with Israel, is that he's more interested in the process, being involved in the process, than in peace itself, and that his participation in the U.S.-led Gulf War coalition and in the Madrid peace process was simply to build bridges with the United States. But Assad recognized that with the Cold War over, with his superpower patron, the Soviet Union, less capable of providing political, economic, military support, that he had to open up to the West. And therefore, they attempted to improve relations, and relations have improved between Syria and the United States in the 1990s. They've had its ups and downs, and it's really a function of the peace process itself. As far as the Syrian people, anyone who's spent time over there, they obviously, as peoples below the government level all over the world, they very much admire and like American culture and want more of it. And that's something I think that Bashar Assad, if he continues to rule, will bring into Syria.
We're talking about the new Syria, the next Syria, Syria after the long-term president Hafez al-Assad, 1-800-423-8255 makes the Syria connection, but 1-800-423-TALK. Fareed is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Fareed.
I'm calling with some mixed feelings. Memory of a Syrian friend who died about 3 weeks ago. He was originally from Hama, and his, I think his uncle was died as a result of the events that took place in 82.
Yeah, recall those events. The Hama was wiped out, in effect.
Yes, wiped out. They basically took one of 5mm cannon from the Israeli border, brought them to Hama, and leveled it. There's an interesting passage in Kanan Makiya's book called Cruelty and Silence on the destruction of Hama, which is quite moving. So I'm sorry this friend died before the death of Assad. I think he would have derived the same kind of satisfaction I'd derived from seeing Saddam Hussein die. I'm originally Iraqi. At any rate, I wanted to ask a question about the future of Syria, not the past. In particular, I remember having read a article on the arguing that tribal space, the Alawite tribal space in Syria would be destroyed precisely because they have managed to hold on to power and to weave themselves into the power structures of Syria. The argument that the author was making, I think he was a French diplomat, was that Assad has been trying to build relationships, linkages through marriage and business partnerships with the bourgeoisie, with the merchant families of Damascus and Aleppo and other places in Syria. Bashar is, you know, part of that. The question that I have is, who are the people who will be holding the power levers in Syria, to, in addition to the military, as control moves on from the military instruments to more economic ones? Who will be making the real decisions in Syria?
Who are in the real permanent club of power in Syria today?
Who are the young Turks, if you will?
Ahmed Khalidi.
I don't see any fundamental shift here from what has been the case under Hafez al-Assad, at least not for the short term. The Syrian system is based essentially on a trade-off, or has been based essentially on a trade-off. After an initial period where Alawite rule was very much resented by the Sunnis, What Hafez al-Assad in particular brought to Syria with the Alawite control of the military and the security apparatus was the kind of stability that Syria had lacked for many decades before. And for the Syrian merchant class who, prior to the Ba'ath coups of the early 60s, which brought the Ba'ath party to power in Syria, for the Syrian merchant class, Sunnite merchant class, this became the bedrock of their relationship with the new regime. You provide us with security and stability, and we will do the trading, and we can be partners together in this. And I think this will remain more or less the case. The existing power structure based on the army, based on the Alawite control of the levers of power, will continue in this kind of partnership, perhaps with more within what one might loosely call the rule of law, and perhaps with a greater openness in terms of liberal economics, but certainly more or less along the same trajectory as before.
Are there other young Turks that Bashar has to deal with?
Well, Bashar's primary concern now, I think, is to make sure that there's no challenge from within the Alawite community, because if he faces a serious challenge from within his own community, then he will have a serious challenge in the country as a whole. So I think as long as the community as such feels that he is able to represent them and offer them the kind of protection that they need, then I think he is relatively safe. I don't see, incidentally, the Rifat, the brother, as being able to mount a credible challenge for the time being, at the very least.
Scott Peterson.
Go
ahead.
Just a quick addendum to that. This is one of the reasons, because of that fear of the possibility of some kind of challenge coming from within the Alawite community, I think you're correct in speaking about Rifat as being not a credible
challenge, but this is one of the reasons to reassure everybody that that basically Bashar was named the commander-in-chief the day after his father died. The fact that just within the first 2 days, we've seen a backing from the military for him. We've also seen Parliament very quickly and conveniently amend the Constitution in such a way that would basically allow a 34-year-old to be the president when before the age limit was 40. So very, very quickly, all of these things have been falling into place, and all of them pointing toward an immediate assurance of stability, which, as you pointed out, is what is most important in so many people's minds.
Scott Peterson, you rove far and wide in the Middle East and Africa. You compared the sort of look of Damascus in a very general way to that of Cuba. Compare it briefly before the break to the other Middle Eastern capitals, you know.
Well, what's interesting about Syria is, though it has such a close relationship with Lebanon, Lebanon and Beirut has a much, much more sophisticated infrastructure, much more sophisticated banking and financial and communications setup. Everything about Lebanon is a remarkable, sophisticated, modern place. And what I find extraordinary is that the Syrians, instead of actually drawing the lessons of what has made Lebanon work and applying it to Syria, have actually instead exported their own money and everything else, and have dabbled in Lebanon themselves because that's where their money can be safe. That's where they can themselves make profits.
Scott Peterson, I got to thank you and let you go. We'll be back with Ahmed Khalidi and David Lesh shortly. This is The Connection from WBUR. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about Syria. After the long reign of President Hafez al-Assad, our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guests are Ahmed Khalidi, Palestinian writer on the Middle East, senior member of St. Anthony's College at Oxford, and from San Antonio, Texas, David Lesh, professor of Middle East history at Trinity University, and a friend, after fashion, of the American-trained successor, Bashar Assad, in Damascus. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Whither Syria connection. Shalom is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Shalom. Welcome.
Yes. Greetings to all of you. My question and comment relates to relationship, the connection, really, between Syria and Lebanon, with, in effect, a satellite state of Syria, like Poland and Hungary used to be of this old Soviet Union. And I wonder what speakers have to say about the possibility, if Bashar unilaterally or as part of agreement withdrew the forces of Syria, which are 30 or 35,000 from Lebanon, and after being reassured by the Lebanese party that there will be no new civil war, permitted them to declare free elections and total independence. This would reassure the whole region that there is no expansionist intention along the greater Syria, which would include Lebanon and Israel and Jordan and Palestinians, and also would make a powerful statement in support of democracy, because Lebanon used to be the only Arab democratic state. And I wonder what your participants think would be the chances of such a declaration, and what would be the reasons for and against it.
It's an interesting question. David Lesh, could I ask you first, what is the logic in the year 2000 of this Greater Syria idea?
Well, I don't think that Lebanon is going to be freed, so to speak, anytime soon. Bashar al-Assad had no real official position before his father died, except for president of the Syrian Computer Society, but he was given the Lebanese portfolio because in handling Lebanon for Syria. And Lebanon is exceedingly important for Syria economically. Particularly before the Israeli withdrawal as leveraged through Hezbollah vis-a-vis the peace negotiations with Israel and withdrawal from the Golan Heights, and I think still can be used as leverage vis-a-vis Israel and will be used with leverage. And this is one of the things I think where Bashar is not going to make any dramatic moves in the near future. And so unfortunately, I think for those Lebanese that would like the removal of those 30,000 Syrian troops, I think they're going to remain for the foreseeable future.
Ahmed Khalidi, where did the Greater Syria idea come from, and what's its meaning today?
Well, I don't think for the Ba'ath Party, which Hafez Assad represented, it wasn't really Greater Syria as such. Greater Syria was the term that was used to describe the fact that Lebanon, what is today Lebanon, was until the early 20s part of Syria, and Greater Syria is a general term to cover the Lebanese-Syrian geographic and political area, including the fact that historically the area of Syria, what the Arabs call Bilad al-Sham, has extended sometimes into Palestine, sometimes into Jordan. But from Hafez al-Assad's point of view, or from the point of view of the Ba'ath Party, I think the issue is not so much Greater Syria as that of a general sense of being Arab nationalist and a general sense of wanting to have a strong and unified Arab nation. This waned over the years. I think by certainly 67 was a watershed. By the early 70s, I don't think the issue was anymore trying to build a unified Arab or singular Arab state. Syria, under Hafez al-Assad, tended to look more towards its own immediate interests. And this is where Lebanon really comes in. Less as an ideological issue today, I should say, and more as an issue of immediate security and stability for the Syrians, the possibility or the danger that Lebanon will break down again into sectarian, warring sectarian factions is still there. And as long as there is no real sense of deep stabilization in Lebanon, and I think it's fair to say that although much has been achieved since the early 90s, this has not been entirely resolved. And the Syrians are not going to move out of Lebanon as long as they think that on this flank of theirs, the possibility that the state will completely collapse as it did between 1970 and 1975 and 1990 might happen again.
1-800-423-8255 makes the With Assyria connection. A Syrian businessman is on the line. He lives now in the United States. He prefers that we not use his name, which I don't know anyway. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What shall we call you?
Sam.
Sam. Tell us your own perspective, including the business perspective, on Syria's future. What is the business climate
in Syria? I think that's the second challenge, you know, or one of the major challenges which Bashar is going to face, because he has two powers to challenge in his country and to keep stability, you know, where, if he will rule it, you know, and that's what we might see for the next 1 year or 6 months.
What is it we'll see?
We will see, you know, two challenges. First of all, the army, and second, you know, those influential business people, you know, who has kind of a control of that. They are like the decision maker, you know, in the country, and they brought up and raised, you know, in certain kind of businesses and in a certain way of dealing with businesses, which has to do with corruption, you know. And I don't believe that those people they are gonna let it loose immediately, you know, and that easy, because their benefits, they are going to be out. And the new generation, which Bashar is going to, he is really encouraging, they, most of them, they've been raised or studied or educated, you know, in the West and or in the United States. So they have a different vision of the old generation. So again, the second challenge is going to be between the businesses, between the old generation and the young generation. Would they have complete different respect of businesses and different idea? And the older one, I don't think they're going to let it that easy.
Can I just say, I mean, I don't know if you're listening, but Ahmed Khalidi was speaking of a kind of trade-off between the Alawit minority that runs the government and the military with the Sunnite majority. But the trade-off is essentially a control of the military on one hand in exchange for the delivery and the guarantee of a certain stability for the Syrian merchant class. Is this changing? Must it change?
I didn't hear you well.
Sam, well, I'm just wondering, is it a stable deal, in effect, between the Alawite military and political control and the stability of the merchant class?
For the time being, yeah, it's an exit change. It's an exchange, you know. I cannot hear you well, but I think, you know, I get your question, and I think it's kind of an exchange, you know, exchange power and exchange relation between both of them, and I think they will let it go for 1 year, and if he start, you know, doing all this anti-corruption, they're going to be rich in one point or other. Otherwise, I don't believe if they are, it's not going to be reaching, you know, those business people too, who I think that's not real anti-corruption.
Could I ask you, Sam, do I take it that you know Bashar Assad himself?
Yeah, kind of. We know him.
What do you know about him?
Well, he's a nice young man, you know, who been, in a way, obliged to move back to Syria in 1994 after his brother death, you know, and he been raised and planned, you know, to continue his career, you know, not as a politician, not as a leader, but the situation, it puts him into it, you know. And for the first couple of years, you know, I think he was mostly concentrated in the technology, in the internet, and these issues, you know, and he carried the second responsibility after he held the Lebanese parliament. But before that, he was really pushing, you know, in the high tech, in the internet, which, again, until now, it's not freed in that country. You can see few people, you know, using the internet, which was the idea since late 1994 that will be available and free to every person in Syria. And until now, we didn't see it.
Ahmed Khalidi, I wonder what's your translation? Decode this word corruption and anti-corruption, which Sam says is a kind of critical test for Bashar in this first year.
Yes, I think that's one way of putting it. Of course, I think there's a genuine root to this. There's no doubt that there has been an abuse of power amongst the old power elite. I think Assad Senior was increasingly aware of this, and it did no credit to the regime to have it, you know, happen with no control. So part of it is a kind of reconsolidation of the regime itself. Part of it is a genuine attempt to root out malpractices, and part of it has to do with the power struggle over the succession and the consolidation of Bashar's own power base. So I would put it down to all these three factors.
Sam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Calling 1-800-423-8255. Sultan is on the line. Hello, Sultan.
It's a sad commentary on this funeral on Arab world in general that a young man promoted to a lieutenant general in a day, constitution changed in 5 minutes. It's really sad to see that in this day and age that this thing happening in a country. And we, as a champion of democracy and human rights, we're accepting it. So it's father after son, son after son, 30 years. Now Bashar is good for 30 years and rule in Syria. Where do we stand in this you know, in this part of the world as a human rights and giving rights to the people to vote and we damn well, instantly, you know, interestingly, Iran, which has three elections in a matter of the last 10, 15 years. I don't know where do we stand in terms of those bigger issues. And even you didn't mention anything about those things. And I was disappointed that my friend Chris even didn't mention that, you know, what about democracy in these countries? What about human rights in these countries?
It's a perfectly good question, Sultan. I mean, we don't kid ourselves that this has been a dictatorship, and the succession is handled in the fashion of a dictatorship, too. What should we make of it, David Lesh? And Sultan, I mean, what would you be doing if you were Madeleine Albright?
What we're doing for the rest of the world, like, for example, a little country like Burma, you know, even Massachusetts is boycotting them, the dictatorship, but then over here, about 46 countries of Middle Eastern, and, you know, dictatorships are their prime. This funeral is like a who's dictatorship, you know, who's a bigger one? They're all Pakistani there, and... And we even in our political discourse we don't say even word. As I said, I'm disappointed. Even you didn't mention anything about this thing. You know.
Well, Sam, I mean, Sultan, how would you have put it?
I would put it that we should not we should be tough on and we should allow in tough or whatever. We should encourage democratic rule in these countries. Let the people have power, and not and should not be acceptable this thing that every president is grooming his son. Everyone is, you know, 30 years in power and ruthless, and you know, no respect for any kind of human rights. The countries are backward to stone ages, really no development in many, many years, because the whole government is just nothing but the security, internal security forces are increasing, and we just, because I think we are neglecting that because of the oil in that country, in that part.
Well, it's not oil in Syria, it is military and strategic and sort of geographic position.
But I think if you give the people power, they were not going to be... People power doesn't mean that it's anti-American. I mean, you know, in general, people in those countries, they respect the USA. They like to be. And on one hand, you see people wearing Gaps and McDonald's and all that. That doesn't show enmity or hate for the USA.
I'd like to toss it to Ahmed Khalidi. What would it take to encourage little buds and blossoms of democratic energy in Syria today? Or is it out of the question?
We have to take our friend Sultan's comments on board. I mean, obviously what's happening is not a shining example of democratic rule. The very fact that you have what is on paper a strict secular republic, that you have a kind of monarchic succession is in itself, I think, you know, remarkable, to say the least. But I think we also have to weigh it against other things. I don't want to make too much of this business of stability, because that very often tends to be an excuse. But we have to remember that Syria is a mosaic of many different minorities and cultures. It has in the past had a tendency to be very volatile, very unstable. There are certain virtues which I think the Syrians themselves accept, that in return for maybe lesser kind of political freedoms that you get in the West, you get something else which makes your life, your daily life, bearable, and in fact you may even flourish. And I think this is the careful path that Bashar will try to tread. I don't see him going too far out in any great experiment in democracy. On the other hand, I don't think it really is the business of the United States or anybody else to try and persuade him or push him or direct him or his people in the way that they choose. There will be changes. They will happen because the Syrians see them as necessary, and they will happen because, by and large, I think the whole area is moving towards a greater sense of pluralism and democracy, whether the rulers like it or not.
Could I ask you both, Ahmed and David Lesh? Shimon Peres, the former prime minister in Israel, commented that Assad's successor is the times, not any one man, and that Bashar, or whoever it turns out to be, will have to accommodate the times. What does that say about the peace process? And where does Syria stand now after the death of Hafez al-Assad?
Christopher, can you hear me?
David Lesh, please.
Yes, I was cut off for a moment there. What it means, obviously, I think the peace process is moribund for some time, maybe a year or two, in my opinion, simply because Bashar has to consolidate his position within Syria. And, you know, even those who in Israel who, again, as I said earlier, were suspicious of the motives of Hafez al-Assad, and even those who questioned peace with Syria, one thing that they found attractive in Hafez al-Assad was the stability he brought to the country. In that, you know, if a deal was struck with Syria, Assad had a history and reputation of making deals stick, and he could enforce compliance. And this provided a comfort level to the Israelis. Now that Bashar or whoever comes to power or really rules in Syria, I think the Israelis are going to want to take, as well as the United States, is going to want to take a wait-and-see approach and just see how much power Bashar really has, and can he bring the country to make the concessions necessary for peace and, more importantly, enforce compliance once the peace is consummated.
Ahmed, you said he can't give up his father's kind of very strategic aloofness. What can he do?
Well, I think less strategic aloofness and more to do with the price or the perceived price that Syria is being asked to pay for a settlement. I don't see Bashar either having the willingness or the readiness to deviate very far from the lines set down by his father and by the regime as a whole. The Syrian, talking about greater Syria and talking about Arab nationalism and the kind of thing, you know, ideological impulses that affect Syria. I think one thing that is very important, Syria is very conscious and always has been of its own need to consolidate its sovereignty and its own borders. It's very protective of its own borders. This is nothing unique to states in the area. I don't see them giving up their claim on the whole of the Golan up to the June 4th borders. And I don't see that Bashar will have the inclination to do so, perhaps not even, as David Lesh has pointed out, not even the time to do so or to address the issue seriously anyway during the next year or so, as he's preoccupied with consolidating his internal position. But I think, you know, the Israeli side also has to consider whether the 100 meters that blocked the deal with Hafez al-Assad are now worth perhaps reconsidering and perhaps even offering to Bashar for the sake of a greater prize, which is which would be a truly remarkable transformation of the relationship between the two countries.
Israel is not the only strategic neighbor. What are the pressures from the others, like Turkey and Iran and Jordan and Syria's old friend Egypt? What are their relations with the Palestinians into the new century?
If you wanted to draw up a list, a sort of list of priorities or an agenda for Bashar, I think you'd start off probably with the internal situation, then go to Lebanon, and then Israel, and then Turkey, and then Iran, and then the internal Arab scene, Jordan, Egypt, Palestine. All of these are very important factors, and standing perhaps on its own, almost as a sort of separate class, is the issue of Iraq. The Ba'ath Party, which rules both Syria and Iraq, supposedly espouses the same values, the same Arab nationalist outlook. Now, of course, there was a very bitter rivalry between Assad and Saddam Hussein. I don't see this being mitigated by the fact that the Assad senior is now gone and Bashar has taken his place. But from the Syrian perspective, what happens in Iraq will be of great, great importance, almost as important as anything else in the regional sphere.
Meaning what, though? I mean, what could happen and what would be the effect on?
Well, one of the things that I think Syria will be wary of is a new Iraq that may perhaps join in with Jordan and or perhaps even assuming Saddam Hussein departs the scene one way or another, and hopefully he will do so quite soon. If assuming this happens, there is a possibility that Syria might be the odd man left out in the area, especially if this is followed by Iraq making its own peace with Israel. That in turn will affect the nature of the Syrian-Iranian relationship, because Syria and Iran have been very close to each other over the past two decades, and part of this is because they have a joint concern about Saddam's Iraq. So any change in Iraq is going to affect Syria's regional position as well as its own relationship with Iran. And that's the kind of merry-go-round that you can, or strategic merry-go-round that you can look at the area when you're trying to look a few steps beyond what exists today.
It looks more from here like a chessboard than a merry-go-round. David Lesh, do you want to predict on any one of those points that Ahmed has left us with?
Always a chessboard rather than a merry-go-round in the Middle East.
David Lesh in San Antonio, thank you enormously for joining us. Ahmed Halady at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, thank you enormously for being on The Connection. Thanks also to Scott Peterson, who joined us earlier in the hour from Damascus. Listeners, you can continue the Syria conversation on our website at theconnection1word.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Corporate Technologies, an elite enterprise certified Sun Microsystems partner, delivering production-quality web applications, cptech.com. Mage, an executive coach.